to promote my new flower shop, I had one place print my business cards, another print my brochures, and a third, my signs. Now my roses aren't red, my violets aren't blue, my geraniums look dead, and I don't know what to do.
Staples can help your business stand out with signs, banners, and brochures that are a true reflection of your company. And now with Staples, spend $50 or more on print and marketing services and get $5 off your next in-store purchase.
Now my business is blossoming and I'm spending less green.
Exclusions apply. In-store only. Ends 6/23/18.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Authentic Woman. This is your host, Shannon Fisher, and I'm excited about the guest I have tonight. She is a fixture in publishing. She's a New York Times best-selling author, and she also was the editor-in-chief of Cosmopolitan magazine for a number of years. And she's had experience in just about every aspect of the writing and publishing industry, and she's also all about female empowerment. So she's perfect to have on The Authentic Woman. So without further ado, I would like to introduce Kate White. Kate, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming on today. You've got such a prolific body of work. It's difficult to know where to start, but I guess really the beginning is what gave you your love of writing.
It's one of those things, Shannon, as I've thought back on it, I realized that it just seemed to be there from the beginning. I have a fond memory of being in first grade, and the teacher, a little assignment, and of course in first grade, you're not writing very much. You're just writing little block letters and doing just bare minimum stuff. But, and I remember her asking us to write something and sort of telling us what she wanted us to write. And it was kind of specific. And I ended up just deciding I was going to write what I wanted to write.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote a little story about my grandfather taking us to the two of us to see some ducks. And one of the ducks was in the road and my grandfather got out of the car to kind of shoo the duck out of the way. And the duck kind of flew up in his face and it made me laugh in the car. And I wrote this story, and I'm sure it was so primitive. And everybody gives their little assignment in to the teacher, mm-hmm. and the teacher gives them back later, and mine doesn't come back. I remember thinking, oh, no, I didn't do what I was supposed to do, and I'm going to get in trouble.
Oh, no.
Later, she reads mine to the class, or she has me read it to the class. I don't remember, but I do remember she had me go and read it to the other two classes, and then she mounted it on purple construction paper and hung it in the front of the class. And, of course, now we probably wouldn't do that to the other kids in the class because that's mean, but to me it was so empowering. It basically said, if you write something that you really want to write, and even if you're breaking the rules a little bit, you will get big rewards for doing it. So I think from then on, I just love the idea of writing.
Oh, that's wonderful. What a fantastic experience to have so early on to really kind of formulate your knowledge of your own talent.
Well, it was wonderful. And of course, you wish you could have found that teacher years later and thanked her, but didn't have the chance to do that.
And we didn't have Facebook back then, unfortunately.
right, exactly.
Well, you, speaking of Facebook and digital, you were at the helm of Cosmopolitan magazine really during the digital transformation when things were going from largely print to print and online. So how did that impact what you did as editor-in-chief there?
Well, when I got to Cosmo, there was one person who was in charge of something called our website.
Mm-hmm.
And it was so primitive then and so minor. And I just thought, I've just inherited a job that I didn't ask for. I was just told, Kate, you're the new editor of Cosmo. And it was the biggest job in the company. The job they used to say, hey, this is the magazine that keeps the lights on at Hearst. Cosmo was so successful and profitable. And I almost wish I didn't have to also focus on the internet component of it.
Mm-hmm.
But one of the things I kind of live by as a leader was something I heard a management guru say once, that times have changed, and the days when you used to be able to tell yourself, after we get done with the budget, we can just kind of get back to normal. There is no normal. It's all whitewater rafting. And you can't let yourself panic too much. You can't get way ahead of yourself. You just got to focus right there and try to juggle those balls. And I said, I'm going to commit to the internet. and do it, the website, and be all in with that. And it was so important to do. And of course, we also did, an incredible app called Cosmo for Guys when I was there, and everything was moving along, and you just wanted to embrace it because you knew that was going to be the future, and you didn't know which parts that were going to pay off more than others. And you couldn't let yourself, your head be turned. One of the interesting things when Twitter happened was I would get a Twitter report every week. Just tell me what Cosmo fans are saying on Twitter. And what they would say about covers, like, oh, I just love that Cameron Diaz cover with the side boobage. What would happen is that would bear no relation to the sales.
Really?
And so Twitter, and I've heard other leaders say that Twitter can be a really inaccurate measure of how your core customers feel and how they're going to perform. So it was interesting to get the Twitter report, and it was interesting to see what people were saying, but I never would have been so stupid to say, let me see how they feel about Kim Kardashian before I put her on the cover, and let that be a way to judge whether she's going to sell. It didn't. In fact, one of the things I did that almost got me a little bit of trouble with this guy ran the entertainment division. When I was doing my second Kim cover, I had begun to see, because of social media and in the internet, that there was a fatigue factor with certain celebrities. And when I shot Kim, I said, for the second time, I said, I don't want you to tweet about it before the cover comes out.
Hmm.
And the mother got very annoyed that momager, like the mother is her manager. Yeah, what she called herself, momager or something.
Yes.
Like that. And she called the head of the entertainment division, who she knew at the Hearst Corporation, and said, Kate White won't let us shoot Kim's cover day for cover shoot for our show.
Hmm.
And he said, what are you crazy? And I said, look, there's a fatigue factor. And why do I want people to see the cover look on the show, then they're not going to go out and spend the money on it.
Absolutely.
And that cover, I just said to him, no, I'm not going to do it just because she's a friend of yours. That cover was the biggest seller of the year. And so you had to be careful about looking at the internet and seeing how you could use it to your advantage and how you could be romanticizing it too much and it might work against you. So I tried to be all in, but also take a lot of it with a grain of salt.
Sure, sure. So you can do market research in certain ways to see what's trending and what to hold back, but you can't trust it as far as what people are going to want to read. Yeah, that's interesting.
Right. The really interesting thing about research, and I'm a big believer in leaders not being afraid of data. There's so much fear that goes into hard and soft data when you see it, and it doesn't say what you want it to say. You can talk yourself out of it. But I really, I'm a big believer in research. But the more you research, that helps you to begin to see what research you can believe and which research you can't. And I would do cover research every year, but I would never ask readers, would you like this person to be on the cover? Because they didn't mean to lie, but they lied. They would tell you, oh, they hate so-and-so, but oh, they'd want to know everything about her.
Right.
So she would end up selling. Or you would put somebody on that they told you they loved, but they might love her, but they didn't care, give a rat's ass about her.
Right.
In terms of reading about her. So what I found really helpful was I did my cover research at the end of the year, and I would bring the covers we had done and get them to talk about why they had bought certain covers and hadn't. And that was far more illustrative for me than asking them ahead of the game. So I think research is so important, but you have to figure out, just as you said, Shannon, what research is true and which isn't, and it takes time to figure that out.
Well, right. And you also kind of have to develop, I would imagine, just a gut for your industry.
A gut, but an educated gut.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that happens is that people love to tell you who you should put on the cover. And when I went to Redbook, I wanted to put Whitney Houston on the cover, and she'd just been in the Bodyguard. And somebody in circulation said to me, oh, the only black woman who sells is Oprah. And I said, but no one's ever put Whitney Houston on the cover before, and I think she'll work. The Bodyguard had been a huge success, and I'd seen it 15 times. So I did it anyway, and it sold great for me.
Yeah.
But that's because it wasn't just a gut thing. I'd looked at the research. I'd looked at the sales for the Bodyguard in terms of box office, and I'd done some research about the appeal of Whitney Houston. So some of it has to be an educated gut. If you just go with your gut, I think you can make a huge mistake sometimes because it has to know something to base its reaction on.
I absolutely agree. I have found whenever I am prepared with information and data going into really anything in life, you're more successful, because even if you don't use all of the information that you have gathered, you're armed with it, and it's bound to help you at some point for sure. So you said something a few minutes ago that I think our listeners will find very interesting. You said you kind of happened upon the editor-in-chief position of Cosmo and weren't really looking for it. So what's the story behind that?
Oh, God. It was the most incredible experience, because I got handed the best job I could have ever imagined, and I probably wouldn't have thrown my hat into the ring if it was out in the open market. The woman who replaced Helen Gurley Brown had, for some reason, I always thought she must be crazy, let Condé Nast Publications lure her away to be editor of Glamour. Hmm. And she went to Hearst and announced that she'd been offered this job, and they tried to negotiate to get her to stay because she'd done a really nice job at Cosmo. But unbeknownst to me, that week, as I lived my life as the editor of Red Book at the company, they were becoming pretty sure she was going to bolt. And they wanted to be ahead of it. So I got a call on a Sunday from my boss, who was the president of the magazine division, saying, can you come in today? There's something we want to talk to you about. I was so like, oh, boy. I said, look, Kathy, if you're going to fire me, just do it over the phone. I'm out in Pennsylvania. I don't want to ruin my weekend completely. And she goes, no. Well, I drove into the city ahead of my family, and I said to my husband, look, I'm not the editor of Red Book anymore, clearly, but I don't know what I am. There had been no rumors. So when she announced I was the editor of Cosmo, I couldn't believe it. And when I got home that night, I didn't have a cell phone then, and told my husband, I'm the new editor of Cosmo. He gets his grin on his face and he goes, wait, I'm going to bed tonight with the editor of Cosmo? And I said, yeah, but I didn't know if I really wanted it. It hadn't sort of been on my radar that much. But boy, once I got into it after the first couple months, I loved it, and it turned out to be a really good fit for me professionally. And I think one of the things that I would say to anyone listening, I spent a lot of time afterwards wondering, why wouldn't I have thrown my hat into the ring if this had appeared on the open market?
Yeah.
Because I would have missed out on the greatest opportunity. And about a year after I'd been at Cosmo, there was a subtitle and a piece we ran called Don't Believe Everything You Think. And a lot of times we just program in stuff about ourselves, things our parents told us, like, you ought to go to law school, or you ought to be a teacher, or you ought to be a nurse. And it's really important to, I think, sometimes step back and just ask, why am I saying that? So let's say the job had appeared. I'm sure people would have said to me, hey, you going to go after that? And I had said no. It would have been important for me to step back and say, well, why wouldn't I? Is it just because of fear? Do I not see myself able to run a magazine like that? What would be the harm of at least going to the first interview? I think that's really important to do. Don't believe everything you think.
That is a really great way of putting it, because we carry these ideas in our minds and things that we can't do. And if someone says that we're not smart when we're 5 years old, then when we're 50 years old, something in the back of our mind is still saying we're not smart. It's amazing.
Exactly.
So, okay, so speaking of being five, so from first grade to becoming the editor of Cosmo, how did you get into publishing? How did that happen for you professionally from the beginning?
Well, this was before the internet. And so you didn't have the opportunity then to explore a field the way I think young men and women today have a certain advantage. It's still hard. I would see millennials coming into Cosmo and they wouldn't necessarily know that you couldn't be a writer in the fashion department. Fashion copy was written by somebody more in the copy and articles department. But I was really at a loss, and I knew I wanted to write, and I just thought, well, I'll be a lot of different kinds of writers. I'll write plays and books. I'll write for newspapers. I love magazines. I'll write for magazines. I put out a little magazine in high school on my own. And it was only once I got to New York that I began to realize, well, you can't write for everybody. You've got to kind of pick a lane.
Yeah.
And when I was a senior in college, my college had asked me if I would represent the school in the Glamour Magazine Top 10 College Contest. And I said yes, because I thought if I win, that'll at least be a way to get started in one of those areas I wanted to write in magazines.
Sure.
And I ended up winning. I was on the cover, which my brothers referred to as trick photography. and I worked at Glamour, and that's when I began to realize, wow, you do have to kind of pick a lane. When I was working at Glamour, it wasn't even so common for editors to write books. And so I ended up getting two lanes out of the deal. But that, at the time when I was first pursuing that, wasn't so common. And that's how it began for me. And, of course, it meant that I did give up ever being a playwright. So, hey, Shannon, there's still time.
There's still time, for sure.
And I wrote a nonfiction book in the mid-90s called Why Good Girls Don't Get Ahead But Gutsy Girls Do. And part of it is that I wanted to convey that message, but mainly I wanted to write a book too.
Mm-hmm.
And then I picked my agent based on the fact that I knew she also wrote murder mysteries, because I didn't want to go to my grave without writing those too. And so right before I got the Cosmo job, I started writing when the kids were still in bed on Saturdays and Sundays. And I got about 3 or 4 chapters of a murder mystery. And generally with fiction, you have to write the whole book. But the company that had published my nonfiction was willing to take a look at it. And they loved it and said, look, we'll give you a 2-book deal. And so I ended up thinking I wasn't going to be able to do it when I got to Cosmo. That the job was going to mean, look, there's no way you're going to be able to continue with it.
Yeah.
But a really kind of funny thing happened where the Christmas after I got the job, and I'd gotten it in August, I had a few days off and I was home with the kids and my husband, and I took those chapters out of the drawer and I started reading them. And what I didn't remember was that the nanny who dies, I'd had her body found on a copy of Cosmo. And I didn't even have the job yet when I wrote that. And I thought, I'm going to take this as a sign. So I got up early and wrote on Saturdays and Sunday mornings, and usually for about an hour during the week. And now it's called a side hustle when you do something like that. Back then it was just my plan B.
Right. That is amazing. Well, and to have that kind of drive, like you said, gutsy girls succeed. And so you decided you were going to take the bull by the horns and do what it was that you wanted to do, which is great.
Well, I think for me, part of that fierceness of doing it came from, one, having that dream to do it and not wanting to give it up, because writing usually did involve just picking one lane.
Mm-hmm.
Or two. And I didn't want to give it up. But also, in my business, they love to boot you out in your 50s. And so I could see that. I could see editors-in-chief who lost their jobs in their 50s, and then they couldn't get hired to do another magazine.
Sure.
And I thought, I just want to have a plan B. And I was lucky. I got to leave when I wanted to, but there was no guarantee of that. And just because you're good doesn't mean there's going to be a guarantee of that.
That is
but
right.
But for me, it was a side hustle that was really my plan B. Now, the only thing I'd say is I hear a lot of bosses complain today that Gen Y, the millennials, are so interested in the side hustle that they're not all in with their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And not everyone is going to find that their side hustle is a brilliant idea that's going to make a lot of money. And then at the end of the day, you may be much better off moving up the ladder at a company, moving around in your industry, making great money and getting great perks rather than going off and doing something on your own. So be all in, even if you've got the side hustle.
Yeah, absolutely. And most people don't have a plan B that ends up putting them on the New York Times bestseller list. That is a that's rare for a plan B. Most people, even if that's their plan A, it doesn't work out. So clearly you're
well, you know, Shannon, one thing that helped, though, is, of course, I was able, part of what helped it become a New York Times bestseller was the fact that I was at Cosmo and got some PR because of that. And got noticed because of that. So that day job can really help.
Oh, for sure. You've got to take advantage of all the contacts and all the publicity you possibly can. Now, you also do a lot of public speaking in addition to writing best-selling novels and having been at the helm of magazines. You do a lot of speaking that empowers women on how to get ahead. So what kind of suggestions do you have for the listeners? Just kind of the basis of if somebody is sitting at home right now with a dream of what they want to do and haven't a clue where to start, what would you tell them?
One of the things that I found really enlightening about that area was based on something that the conclusion I made after interviewing a lot of women for one of my career books. I didn't put this in the book. It wasn't what the book was about. But after I'd sent the book off to the publisher, one of the things I realized is that all of these successful women I interviewed had figured out what they wanted, not by sitting down with a legal pad or doing the workbook part of what color is your parachute. They'd figured that out by bumping into it someplace.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, going to hear a talk one night and having the person to talk about their career and thinking, wow, that sounds really interesting. I might like to do that. And my fashion editor at Cosmo once told me that she figured out what she wanted to do after she got out of college when she went to Africa with her boyfriend, and she'd been an art major and didn't know what she wanted. But while they were traveling by bus through Egypt, she saw at a bus stop a German fashion magazine doing a fashion shoot, and she saw the stylist at work, and it was just a eureka moment. Oh, that's what I want to do. And as she said so poetically, sometimes you have to be on the bus to Cairo to figure out what you want. And I really believe if you're not sure what you want, you get out in the world, you go down the rabbit hole in the internet and just explore a lot of stuff. You go to galleries, you go to talks, you go to your friends' workplaces and say, when we go out to lunch today, can I pick you up at your job? I just want to see where you work. And you help yourself find that eureka moment. And I think that's the way it really does happen. And so you have to be out in the world to have that eureka moment.
That absolutely, that's how it happened with me with this radio show. I am on the board of a women's rights organization, and Pam Stack, the head of the Authors on the Air Network, reached out to women's organizations to look for people to be panelists on a show about domestic violence. And I, you know, wrote back to her and was a panelist on the show. And then I reached out to her and I said, hey, you know, we'd like to do something about human trafficking. She said, okay, great. I would love to partner with you on that, but would you host it? And I thought, okay, I think I can do that, never having done radio before in my life. And so I hosted it, and she called me the next day and said, would you like to do a weekly show on the network? And I just thought, did that really just happen? I mean, did I really go from being a panelist on a domestic violence show to suddenly having a radio show? And that's how it happened. I was essentially on the bus to Cairo. That is, it really is how it happened.
And did you find that when you were on the panel that time? Did you find it exhilarating to be on the air and talking? And then when you did the guest interviewer, did you find it exhilarating? And did you actually think, God, this could be fun?
Oh, I loved it. I mean, I was nervous ahead of time because, you know, like you were saying earlier, I wanted to be extremely prepared. And so I did a bunch of research to make sure that I was booking the right guests and getting everybody together for the panel on human trafficking. And then when the day came and we did the show, I just thought, this is easy. And I mean, it's not easy because I've been doing all this preparation, but it just felt right. It was exhilarating. And I kind of exhaled like, oh, okay, this is what I'm supposed to do. It makes sense now.
Wow. That's great. Yeah. And if you're not out in the world, you're not going to bump into it, and you're going to end up just kind of spinning around in your mind, going over the same things.
That's right. That's right. Well, you took your plan B, and you've now written 10 novels. So what gives you your inspiration to keep going and to keep coming up with fiction material? Because that's all coming right out of your mind.
Yes. And I would say, if I look back at some of the big ideas that I had at Cosmo, a lot of them came from always using the question, what if? And with every idea, asking yourself, could this be bigger? Could it be more badass? For instance, with fiction, what they really encourage you to do, there's even a book called What If, is to take a little germ and start to play with it. I went to a conference this past weekend called Thriller Fest, and there was a really great best-selling thriller writer called C.J. Box, and he was talking about where the idea for his latest thriller came from. He had heard somebody, I think the head of the FBI, say, we're investigating terrorism in every state. And he thought, whoa. And he's from Wyoming. And so he said, holy cow, that means my little state. Mm-hmm. I had no idea that was the case. And that became the, well, what if there really is terrorism in my little state? And I'm going to start to write a book on that. But that works not just with fiction. I think that it's really great sometimes if you can take any little idea and start to go bigger with it. When I was driving to work one day when I was the editor of Cosmo, I heard on the radio the stat that the fastest growing cancer for women in their 20s was melanoma. Mm. And that's not only because of being in the sun, but tanning beds. They are really dangerous. And I thought, oh, as soon as I go to work, I'm going to crash something in the latest issue about this. But I started to say, well, what if I could go bigger with it? And I came up with the idea I wasn't just going to do something in one issue. I was going to do something in almost every issue and create a campaign that we later called Practice Safe Sun.
Oh.
And then as I started to think, could I go bigger, I went to ABC and asked if they wanted to partner with us on an investigative piece on tanning beds. And I went to my congresswoman and asked if she would be open to sponsoring some legislation, which became the TAN Act, and she sponsored it.
Oh.
And 5 years later, over 50% of our readers had told us they had changed their habits in terms of the sun because of Practice Safe Sun. The TAN Act passed.
That's so fantastic.
We had sold tens of millions of dollars worth of advertising to advertisers who wanted to be connected to Practice Safe Sun, which wasn't the reason I did it, but it was just a fabulous bonus. And so it might not have happened if I hadn't said, well, what if we went a little bigger with this?
Sure.
What if I blew this out? And I think that the whole idea of asking yourself those kinds of questions, how can I run with this? What if I did this? Works not only in fiction, but in business. And you have to get in the habit of doing it, because sometimes people tell me, oh, you know, I think big, I'm a big idea person. But we can so often get drawn back into the way things are always done that you get out of the habit of doing that.
Yes, yes. I mean, that was a stroke of genius. It helped a lot of people in the process. A lot of times, I think that the best results in business do come from having that do-gooder idea in the beginning. You know, you wanted to help, you wanted to spread awareness of this, and then all of a sudden you're getting all of this advertising money because you decided that you wanted to raise awareness. Your favorite
start
part.
From the authentic place, and it, I think just as you said, then it can take you into something that might be profitable too.
Yes. So in the day-to-day of working at magazines, both at Cosmo and the ones where you worked before, what was your favorite part of working at a magazine?
Well, just generating ideas is so much fun. And when you're young and you're a writer, sometimes it can be hard to see what the fun is in being an editor. It's a little bit like people who think it must be so much fun to be on television. Who would want to be the producer, the behind the scenes? But when you are coming up with ideas, it's exhilarating. And at Cosmo, the staff was really incredibly fun to work with. You, as you might imagine, the people who would come to work at a place like Cosmo were very over the top in some ways.
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
We had a very diverse group of 60 people, 65 people working there. And, oh, my gosh, I felt sometimes like I was on the most wonderful television show. Just absolutely great to have people from so many different backgrounds at work there. And I loved every minute of the collaborative process of generating ideas and just the fun of it. And of course, I also liked some of the glamour part too. Cosmo had big people on the cover, and so sometimes I might give a dinner party for Rihanna or go on a shoot with Beyonce or just have dinner with Chris Pine or somebody like that. So that was fun too. Though for me, it was just being in the office, generating ideas, working with great people who I still spend a lot of time with. The people who work for me at Cosmo, several of them are just really close friends now. And that's really great when that can happen for you.
Yeah, that's a great personal legacy to have as well as a professional one. Well, you were there for 14 years, so that inadvertent stumbling into that job, it was the perfect fit. The universe was sending you to the right place for sure.
It was a great part of my career, and I know there are people who probably wondered why would you leave that, but I do think that it's great to realize there are moments where if you've wanted to try something else, you go ahead and you try it. And I laid the foundation. I made sure over the years that I was going to be able to do it financially. I got all my ducks in a row. And I've loved being an entrepreneur. One of the things I discovered that was interesting, that old myth, the average American, is not so old of a myth. It's probably at least 10 years it's been around, but it's that every one of us will have at least 5 careers because of just how things change now.
Right.
Well, that is not true. There's no, they've never been able to find a study that was based on. But I think we can be pretty sure anecdotally that a lot of people now do have more than one career. And when there's something that beckons you and you realize you only have so many years on the planet, it's great to be able to say, maybe I can make that happen. And for me, the freedom of being an entrepreneur, as much as I love my bosses and my company, well, that freedom is delicious.
Well, and you've had that freedom full time now for 3 years. So,
you know, Shannon, it's going to be 4 in August. I realize it's 4 years.
Wow.
Which is a long time, but I've loved it. And my husband and I live in Uruguay a few months every winter. And so it's been a great opportunity to explore even more South America, work on my Spanish, those sorts of things.
So how do you structure your time? We've got a lot of writers who listen to our shows. And one of the main things I hear is, you know, if I do have all of my free time to devote to writing, I can't bring myself to focus. So how do you bring yourself to focus to produce the wonderful work that you're still putting out there?
Well, one of the things I try to do is stay with the idea of what I was doing at the magazine where I got up early. I'm a big believer in if you want to succeed, you want to be one of the first ones in every day because the day can quickly get away from you. And I used to get in Cosmo, not too early, but always by like 7:30 or 8. And that gave me a chance then to work a little bit on my fiction before I turned my attention to Cosmo. Even then, my staff didn't get in until 9:30, so I had plenty of time to get my day started. So what I try to do is just get my butt in the chair by 8:30 every day, and not later than that, because if I let myself just kind of start doing emails or something like that and not focusing on my writing, it's really easy to get pulled away. Another thing that really helped me, years ago, I read a great time management tip that said that if you make a task too big, it'll overwhelm you and you'll avoid it. And the guy said, instead, you should slice it up like a salami. And he called it the slice the salami technique. But I find that that's really helpful when you're working on your own, because when you have a regular job, the ecosystem of your workplace pulls you along. There's a meeting at 10. So you go to the meeting. And then at 11, you've got a conference call. So you do that. I don't have as much of that. So what I try to do is, let's say somebody just asked me to come back and speak at a big conference that I spoke at last year. So I'm really flattered, but they want a new speech, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'll probably do, I won't ever sit down one day and say, today's the day I crank out that speech. What I would do is most likely say, I'm going to put a half an hour aside one day to do a very rough outline. And then another day I'll put aside to flesh out the outline. And then maybe a third day I would put aside some time to research some of the points in the outline. So it never becomes too onerous. And that sounds like I'm a baby, but for me, that makes it easier to deal with stuff. And when I'm here in a home office and I don't have that structure forcing me along the assembly line of the day.
Yes, it's easy to become overwhelmed with large jobs like that. It really is. So that is excellent advice. So everyone out there, listen to the rest of the show. But once the show is over, carve out little pieces of your time and get your projects done. And I mean, that applies to writers and to anyone else who's got their side gigs, their plan B that they're trying to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In fact, when I started writing my book, I had tried to write fiction in my 20s, and I would say, this is before I had kids, I'm going to write all day Saturday. And then I would get up and I would see that a rug pad was sticking out from underneath the rug, and boy, that had to be dealt with right away.
Right.
And all those pills on the sweater, or my wallet needed to be cleaned out, and I would find some task and I would just never get around to it. So knowing I had this problem of having a hard time sticking my butt in a chair, I remember the slice of salami technique, because I had that come up in an interview from back in my 20s. I decided that I would write for only 15 minutes a day in the beginning.
Oh.
And how do you say no to that? There's just, it was really easy to do. And then as the weeks went by, some pages added up, and I loved doing it. I got in the zone, and I would write a little longer. So I think that works for writers and people in business. In fact, I was so flattered one day, this woman came up to me, and she told me she had just found an agent for a book. And I said, oh, great. How long have you been working on it? She says, well, for 6 years, but it just kind of lay in a drawer, and I just finished it in the last 6 months. I said, oh, wow. What inspired you? She said, I heard you tell the slice of salami technique in a talk once.
That's wonderful.
I know a few people who did their books using that technique, me and this wonderful woman, Jessica.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, tell me about your most recent book. You've got your new novel is called The Wrong Man.
Yes, it is. I think an interesting concept. It's a standalone. It's a psychological thriller about a woman who is on vacation in Florida, and she has a one-night stand with a guy that she finds very appealing. And they both kind of he makes it clear to her in the beginning that it's no strings attached, that his life is very complicated right now. And she decides, I don't care. I need to be a bit of a bad girl. But then afterwards, he calls her. They both live in New York City. And he says, look, forget what I said. I really want to see you. Let me fix dinner for you Thursday night. And when she arrives at the door of the apartment that he's texted her, somebody else is there. And she said, I'm sorry, I'm looking for Matt Healy. And he goes, well, I am Matt Healy. And she realizes she's been punked somehow.
Huh.
And then a lot of really bad things begin to happen. And she doesn't know who was that guy. Why did he seem to punk her? Is there something else going on? And it was fun. And I actually even went down to Isla Mirada for a couple days just to check out where I wanted to set it. And I have a new book that's going to come out. I just finished coming out, another psychological thriller called The Secrets You Keep. It'll be out in March. And then I have a Bailey Wagons mystery, my seventh, coming out next October. So I didn't want, with the publishing company, we decided not to bring something out in November because of the election.
Sure.
So it just worked out that I'll have two books next year.
Oh, that's great. So you really are spending a lot of time and cranking out ideas. When you get an idea, where does it usually strike you? When your creative genius strikes, are you in the shower? Are you driving in the car? What is your meditative time where these ideas come to you?
One thing that helped me is something that a woman named Laura Day said once. She wrote, she's kind of kooky, but she wrote this book called On Intuition, and she said, put the question out to the universe. And what that means is it just kind of primes your brain to be receptive. And so whenever I'm ready to do the next thriller, which is generally while I'm finishing one, I'll just say, what am I going to write about now? And I keep a big folder of crime articles, and maybe it's while I'm going through that that I'll see something that I'll think, ooh, you know, that could be interesting. And, or sometimes I'll just see a word someplace or something will happen that you begin to play with. And that's when you do the what if thing I was talking about, where you, let's say you saw something that was about somebody being kidnapped, and you know that people are kidnapped. It's written about a lot. But what if you said, you start playing around, well, what if the kidnapping victim ends up doing whatever? And you just start to play.
Mm-hmm.
And that's often a really fun part of it. The trick is not to panic when it's time to come up with another idea, because what scares a lot of people is, like, what if I don't come up with an idea? But I think if you relax and you just keep yourself asking the universe that question, okay, I've decided I like the idea of something happening to a divorce lawyer. What would be the thing that would happen to that person?
Mm.
And then all of a sudden you look at something and you see it and you think, oh, that's interesting. For me, after I wrote my first mystery, it had taken me so long to come up with the idea. And so I used that, like, what if thing. And it was because I had the idea. I took a day off from work and I put the question out to the universe, kind of panic stricken. What the heck am I going to write about?
Yeah.
And I went and got a manicure and a facial. And when the facials left the room, I looked down at her tray and I thought, well, you could kill somebody with one of these things. And then I thought, okay, I'm going to write about a spa. Something happens at the spa.
Yeah.
And then I started to think about, okay, why is Bailey Wagons going to the spa? What could be going on at the spa that could be bad? Why would somebody end up dead there? And it just snowballed from there.
That's fantastic. Just going about your day and doing what you were doing. You were riding the bus. Was it
to Cairo? That's
Cairo.
Right.
You were riding the bus to Cairo. That's awesome. So
I do think, Shannon, it's so important to ask to put the question out there. It's not that it's a mystical thing, but you're just getting your subconscious ready, primed to accept things that are out there. And I've actually heard other creative people talk about doing that too. And I would do it at Cosmos. Sometimes when I feel it was time for the magazine to be updated, I would think, okay, what am I going to do now? And then I would see something that would make me think, okay, that's something I can start to play with.
Yes, yes. And that, and play with it you do. So 10 works of fiction later and umpteen speeches and articles. And when you have that creative spark within you, it is an endless well. It really is. So for people who are out there, and I think anybody listening is going to want to know this, who want to break into publishing, who want to break into magazine writing, or who have, say, written a book and are trying to get it published, what advice do you have for people who don't have connections, who don't know anybody and don't have a degree in it? What can they do to help themselves succeed?
Great question. I think in terms of print magazines today, or magazine world, including their websites, it's really important to understand that world is shifting. And, you know, Cosmopolitan, just in the 4 years I was gone, it sells over 60% less on the newsstand than it did when I was there. I mean,
wow.
That's a pretty huge decline. And it's reflective to some degree of what's happening in the publishing business overall. These magazines that were such powerhouses years ago just aren't selling because 19-year-olds aren't buying them anymore. They're getting their information other places.
Yeah.
And they're on Facebook. They're getting material aggregated for them and sent to their phones. And when I am out speaking at colleges and I meet 19-year-olds who are want to get into magazines, I say to them, look, your roommate is the reason this is a problem. She's not buying any magazines. Nor is the girl across the hall from you. You may be buying them, but they're not.
Right.
So I think going into that world, you just have to think, I'm going to be a content creator.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to know how to write for a blog. I'm going to know how to write for an internet site. I'm going to know how to write for magazines. And even while I'm still in college, I'm going to start my own website and I'm going to have a blog and I'm going to make it smart. I'm not going to say anything stupid that somebody be able to track down when I apply for a job someplace.
Yeah.
With books, we hear a lot about self-publishing, and certainly that does work for some people. But still, most people would tell you, look, it's traditional publishing that has the opportunity to really bring you money if you take off. And what you need is you need a killer idea. You need a big idea. And I had a dinner party the other night. It was so great. Lee Child was there, who sold over 100 million Jack Reacher books.
Mm-hmm.
Gillian Flynn, who wrote Gone Girl. Karen Slaughter, who sold, I think, 40 million books. Megan Abbott. It was just a great group of people. And every one of them has fought really big. And as the stakes have been raised, you can't come out with a kind of a quiet idea anymore. You
yeah.
could, and maybe that's the book you want to write. But if you want to write something that explodes onto the scene, it better have a big idea behind it. And the first 50 pages are critical. The first page is critical. And I actually love a book called The First 50 Pages that talks about the importance of that. And I also love a magazine called Writer's Digest. There's just tons of fabulous info about getting published, structuring your novel so that it is powerful, writing powerful characters. And don't just sit down to write. Educate yourself to the marketplace. Treat it a little bit like a business, because even Lee Child once said that part of why he made Jack Reacher who he was is that he looked at the marketplace and he said, well, so-and-so is already doing Private Eyes and somebody else is doing this. He was smart. I mean, Jack Reacher is an incredible character. And the second Jack Reacher movie is coming out this fall. And Lee said it's fantastic. Also with Tom Cruise, he thinks it's really great.
Okay.
So The reason he sold over 100 million books is because he did a little market research before he started. He didn't go into an area that was glutted. And I think you have to be smart and be willing to say it is a business. And if you just want to write the book you always wanted to write since you were 10, go ahead, write it, but don't expect it necessarily to take the world by storm. But if you want to write a book that has the potential to be a bestseller, maybe you do think, do a little market research, think about starting off with a bang. I mean, Gone Girl, the reason that book did so incredibly well is because we never read anything quite like it before.
That's very true.
Of course, she is just such a brilliant person. It's hard to top a book like that if you're just plain old me. But still, you got a shot at it if you're willing to go big, I think.
Absolutely. And I don't think there is any plain old you. I think your career just it stands completely on its own merit. And I think that there are so many people out there with great respect for you that are you know, really excited to see all of the content that you continue to produce. And what you were just saying kind of brings us full circle. Do the market research and put the big mm-hmm. ideas out there and don't be afraid. And you are definitely a woman with guts, and it's taken you to where you are.
I would just say the one thing about publishing I've found is that it wasn't a hard field to break into if you had passion and you knew how to write a great pitch letter to somebody and make it personal and say, I want to work in magazines, but I want to work at your magazine. Publishing a book is a little trickier, but I think the more homework you do, the more you understand that so many of the writers at Thriller Fest talked about how long they've been at it. CJ Box, he said it took him 3 years to find an agent for his first book. I believe that he'd written two other books before he wrote that one that he just threw in the garbage. So a lot of it is that grit factor we've heard a lot about. But when people try to scare you away from certain fields, oh, that's so hard to break into, I just say bullshit. I think that there's plenty of room for a lot of people at the table. Just be smart about how you do it, stick with it, and look for opportunity and pick people's brains, and don't be afraid to ask for what you want.
Oh, excellent. I think that's the best advice you could possibly give. Well, Kate White, thank you so much for being on the show today. This has been great.
Oh, Shannon, thank you so much. I wish I could spend the next 40 minutes interviewing you and getting details. It must be boring sometimes to have to ask all the questions when you've had an exciting life yourself.
No, I love learning about people, and I love, you know, being the vehicle for people to share words of wisdom and about their life and just kind of sharing the human perspective. To me is, you know, everybody has a different perspective, and it's wonderful to be part of sharing just even a glimpse of that. It's an honor.
I think just what we're talking about, you're such a good interviewer. You do your homework, and that's part of the stick-to-itiveness, not to just wing it.
Right. Absolutely. Well, anyone out there who wants to find a list and links to Kate's books, you can go to her website, which is katewhite.com. And again, thank you so much, Kate.
Thank you, Shannon.
And for The Authentic Woman, this is Shannon Fisher, and this podcast is copyrighted and owned by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. And until next time, have a good one.
Greatness. It's you donating plasma to help save lives. And now at Grifols Biomat USA and Telecris Plasma Resources, new donors earn $200 in just 3 visits. To find the nearest donation center, go to grifolsplasma.com. Greatness. It's you donating plasma to help save lives. And now at Grifols Biomat USA and Telecris Plasma Resources, new donors earn $200 in just 3 visits. To find the nearest donation center, go to grifolsplasma.com.